Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the choreographed Kim Trump photo op that was very light on substance and even lighter on the takeaway, a one-page signed agreement which promised much less than the 1994 and 2006 joint communiques, which has left almost all specialists on Korea and U.S. officials who have dealt with the peninsula considerably underwhelmed. Grace Liu, a research associate at the East Asian Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies at Monterey, joins us to discuss what was left undone and glossed over, and that is some kind of nuclear arms reduction agreement with North Korea in exchange for vague security guarantees offered by Secretary of State Pompeo, who declined to describe what they might be. With no substantial action forthcoming on denuclearization, the Singapore summit was hardly a victory for disarmament. But now that the door is open for more meetings ahead, we will assess whether at the end of the day, the best deal that could be arrived at between the U.S. and North Korea might end up looking a lot like the Iran deal, which Trump tore up. Then we speak with Kyung-Hoon Hwang, who is a professor of history and East Asian languages and culture at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul, whose most recent study is Rationalizing Korea. He joins us to discuss how the ego-driven amateur who talked of pristine North Korean beaches as real estate opportunities to build condos might just be the best person to pull off this deal, since clearly over the decades the professionals have failed. We will also look into the frightening signal that a desperately poor country devoting all of its resources to make nuclear weapons sends to the world. If you want respect and to be taken seriously, then get a nuke. Then finally, we will speak with the Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy and Distinguished Research Professor of Political Science at York University, Leo Panitch, about President Trump's new best friend, the North Korean dictator he describes effusively as a talented man who loves his country very much. Compared to his newest global enemy, Canada's Prime Minister, who Trump refers to dismissively as Justin. We'll discuss how China reaches out to the world by building roads while Trump builds walls. And joining us now is Grace Liu, who's a research associate at the East Asia Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs. She also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. Welcome to Background Briefing, Grace Liu.
Thank you, Ian.
And I stayed up quite late last night, I don't know whether you did, to see the sort of signing and then the press conference. And I must say that it did really feel mostly like a photo op, very little substance. There was just that one-page communique, and most analysts see it as being much thinner than the 1994 joint communique or the 2006. So if people were looking for nuclear disarmament, they got pretty thin pickings.
Right, exactly. So I think as many analysts have already noted, it was a great press opportunity from the flags aligned right next to each other to the very picturesque location that they chose. It was clearly much more for the press, as you said, than it was for any substantial agreement towards potential denuclearization. So one thing that was really missing, again, like from the previous agreed framework, is any type of technical or substantial way forward for any denuclearization process. So what we're lacking here is a timeline or any type of technical verifiable aspect where we can bring in experts and different officials who can say, yes, this amount of substantial progress has been made towards dismantlement or disarmament.
So the fact that the North Koreans let Sig Hecker in, the former head of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, to look at a lot of facilities, he's made, I think, about 8 trips. I'm not sure the total, but he has made a number of trips. Now, clearly they were designed to send a message to the West about what North Korea has. But could that be a model to build on? I know that was just one individual. You'd need, what, hundreds, if not thousands, of UN inspectors, would you not?
Right. So when we're talking about this buzzword that's been going around, CVID, which is complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement, we're talking about something that has to be done over a long process. And actually, Sig Hecker and one of his colleagues actually released a study recently that outlines a 15-year-long denuclearization plan. So we can see that from a technical side, in order to really verify that this denuclearization has happened, we have to have many experts and technical inspectors involved at every stage of the process to be able to be there in person and document everything that's going on. So that being said, I think having these opportunities where North Korea lets in a scientific expert such as Sig Hecker to go and view the facilities and the capabilities that they have serves two purposes. Like you said, it allows them to a reliable channel to communicate what capabilities that they do have. But then for us on the other side, it also opens up some channel of transparency between the two countries or two actors, or just between North Korea and the rest of the international community. And so to an extent, it is very beneficial for us, and it will continue to be beneficial for them to arrange more of such visits with high-level officials, more preferably, again, scientific experts or non-proliferation experts.
And again, I'm speaking with Grace Liu, who is a research associate at the East Asia Non-Proliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs, and she also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. So for somebody that works in non-proliferation and denuclearization, Grace, do you share my concern that North Korea is sending a rather frightening signal that desperately poor countries devoting all of their resources to make nuclear weapons sends to the world, which is that if you want respect and to be taken seriously, then get a nuclear weapon?
So it certainly seems that way, and I think a lot of other analysts and experts in the non-proliferation field would agree, because it's been less than a year since North Korea successfully tested their first intercontinental ballistic missile. And in less than a year, Kim Jong-un was able to have a meeting, a high-level summit, a highly televised summit with the President of the United States. And so from a visibility standpoint, that does signal a very troubling pattern. I think what will really solidify how this summit is viewed is where North Korea-U.S. relations go from here. So from a disarmament perspective, of course, we'd love to see some type of further agreement that calls upon something like the agreed framework, where technical experts are brought in and we're able to negotiate the beginning steps of a disarmament agreement. However, if this doesn't happen and this just remains a photo op, a press opportunity, and it just seems that North Korea was able to organize this high-level meeting and gain this legitimacy from a bilateral summit meeting with the United States president, then I think that will really solidify that frightening message that, you know, if you're not an economically strong country, you don't have conventional military resources that can stand up to, I guess, these larger militaries in the world, that if you develop nuclear weapons, you can gain that legitimacy and earn a spot at the table with other high-level actors.
But surely you have to add to that the fact that President Trump's making a deal with the North Koreans and offering them this tremendous deal of respect as an equal player on the world stage, at the same time really turning the screws on Iran, who signed the P5+1 deal with the world powers, which he then tore up. So what is that? Where does that leave the Iranians? In other words, they look like suckers because they agreed to disarmament.
Right. So again, I think this will really depend on where U.S.-North Korean relations go from here. So I think if in the next few weeks or next few months the Trump administration does decide to negotiate a more technically verifiable disarmament agreement that is similar to the JCPOA, maybe that will soften the blow in a way so that maybe the Iranians will be more hopeful that the U.S. could either return to the JCPOA or that the U.S. is actually willing to renegotiate such a deal. But also in this international community, I think another actor who could be troubled by the upcoming relations between the U.S. and North Korea is South Korea. And we know that the Blue House is watching very closely at the summit yesterday to see what language would come out of this signed agreement and to see if the U.S. would, in a sense, leave South Korea in the dust and promise to withdraw troops or halt exercises in order to receive some concessions from North Korea.
Well, that's already happened, hasn't it? They were quite alarmed at Trump's remarks that the exercises were provocative and his hints that he might reduce U.S. troops on the peninsula. And also, what do you make of the vague security guarantees offered by Secretary of State Pompeo, who declined to describe what they might be?
So, again, with this administration, I think we really need to wait to see what actions come out of the words that were said. So right now, I think it would be safe to say that we won't see a substantial withdrawal of American troops from the peninsula. And if we see any scaling back of joint exercises, I'm not sure that the president would want to halt exercises altogether, as he's claimed, because that would signal a pretty strong de-escalation of joint U.S. and South Korea and, I guess, cooperation in their security situation. So I think what we can look forward to now is to see how these joint exercises may change, either in scope, in size, or in the type of missions that they're running in these operational exercises. And that may change to signal some de-escalation, but I don't think we'll be seeing any substantial withdrawal of troops.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, what about, since the South Koreans are a key component here along with the Chinese, and we've yet to hear from both, really, and obviously there'll be follow-on meetings, particularly with Putin and Kim and Xi Jinping and Kim, but what about the possibility of some kind? I don't think it was ever mentioned, at least maybe that it was and I missed it. What about some formal end to the Korean War?
So one of the interesting things that I noticed about the signed agreement from yesterday, from the summit yesterday, is the order of precedence that they put the four agreed points in. So I believe the first one was improving U.S.-North Korean relations. And then the second one right below that, even before any talk of denuclearization, was putting an end to the violence between North and South Korea. And so if that order of precedence has any significance, I think Trump and Kim could both benefit from another, maybe not bilateral this time, but multilateral signing of some document that formally ends the armistice and the war in general. So we'll see what form that an official ending of the war could take. I'm not sure if that would be in a signed agreement per se, or maybe, I guess, an official declaration unilaterally or bilaterally from North or South Korea, and then maybe a commencement of something like the six-party talks that brings in not only North and South Korea and the U.S., but Japan, China, and Russia, and other actors in the region.
Well, the only thing that I find a little bit puzzling about this was this, if there is a formal end to the Korean War and it's announced and understood in the North, that's going to take away one of the biggest kind of bogeyman that they have, which is the Americans are about to go to war at any moment, and we're on a constant war footing. So that would really signal a change, would it not?
And I think we've already seen some of that change in rhetoric in the Rodong Shinmun and other North Korean newspapers and news outlets. We've seen less of the antagonizing the Americans and the South Koreans, and more, at least more press coverage in terms of pictures and stories about Kim becoming a more international leader and becoming more involved with other leaders and states and forming these good relationships. And these stories are resounding within North Korea, as far as we know. So we're already beginning to see sort of a shift in the type of regime that Kim is building and the perspective that is being built to portray South Koreans, Americans, and leaders of other countries.
Well, Grace Liu, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Cool. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Grace Liu, who is a research associate at the East Asia Nonproliferation Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, where she focuses on East Asian missile and nuclear programs. And she also serves as an intelligence analyst in the U.S. Army National Guard. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how this ego-driven amateur who talked to pristine North Korean beaches as real estate opportunities to build condos might just be the best person to pull off this deal. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kyungmoon Hwang, who is Professor of History and East Asian Languages and Cultures at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul. His books include A History of Korea and Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. And he's the author of a recent study, Rationalizing Korea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kyungmoon Hwang.
Thank you.
And what do you make of the summit that just took place? Most of the analysis is that it was pretty underwhelming. A number of people who have been Korean analysts and have been involved in Korean affairs in the government have pointed out that the communique that came out of it that they both signed with much pomp and ceremony was in fact thin, and that the communiques in 1994 between the U.S. and North Korea and in 2006 between the U.S. and North Korea were much more substantial and substantive. So it doesn't seem like, in terms of the paperwork, shall we say, that much came out of it. But the theatrics seem to have worked, and I believe there's a great deal of relief in South Korea. What are you hearing from South Koreans?
From South Koreans, they've been, of course, much more interested in this than even the American press has been. I followed this live late last night through the South Korean live broadcasting, and you know they were calling attention to every little facet of what was going on. And for them, the summit was divorced from any kind of consideration of what Donald Trump had been doing before with the G7 summit or his troubles back home in the United States. All these things that we consider as important aspects of the larger context. To the South Koreans, it seems as though that this is a major step that extends the overtures that were made and the more important breakthroughs that were made back in late April with the summit between President Moon of South Korea and Kim Jong-un. So I think from their perspective, and I think from the perspective that we can take as well, despite all the almost childish theatricalities that accompanied this event last night, and despite the fact that there's almost no substance at all to that joint communique or statement that was presented, this is an important step. It's better than, I guess, not having any development that brought greater harmony or lessening of tensions between North Korea and the United States. Of course, the big question is whether this is going to be sustainable. And I actually have no idea whether that's going to be the case.
Well, in many ways, it would seem to me that the fact that President Trump is an ego-driven amateur might well have been why, if this has succeeded, and nobody's saying it's been successful, and everybody's suggesting that we're going to have to wait to see whether there's that substance to the follow-on negotiations. But the point I wanted to make was that, I mean, when you watch the president talk about the pristine beaches in North Korea and how you could put condos on them and what a real estate opportunity it is for the country being between South Korea and China, it's like you can't believe you're hearing that. But on the other hand, maybe it took an amateur to pull this off. I was watching the face of Kim Jong-un, and it seemed to me that he was just as bemused as I was.
Yeah, I noticed that too. You know, when he heard some of the translations of Trump's utterings off the cuff, he seemed bewildered but also bemused, as if he knew that this was coming, and it was just a realization of what he had expected and what he had been briefed upon. So that was interesting to see as well. And I think you have an important point to make that the childishness, the level of juvenilia that Trump displays in these kinds of events and settings might be the crucial element here to move things forward. Because ultimately, in the end, the United States should not play a role. This is something that was explicitly expressed in the statement that was issued back in the April 27th summit between the two Korean leaders. And that is that this is, in the end, a Korean issue. And peace in the Korean Peninsula will be and should be and must be achieved through Korean actions with Koreans at the center. And so Trump has introduced, of course, a wild card into that reality. And so if the more immediate task is to just get Trump out of the way so that he doesn't do something that would bring about destruction, then, yeah, his, you know, childish or amateurish level of approach to everything in this case might actually be a good thing. I hate to think that that's the case, but that might be the reality here.
So there is obviously a great deal of sentiment in the South about reunification and their sense of fraternity with the North, obviously, mm-hmm. but the regimes couldn't be more different. And the political left, which is in power now in South Korea, has always been more open, sunshine policies they've been called over the years. And the right in South Korea basically brands the left as being naive about what this regime really is. I don't think there's any delusions about it, are there? I mean, it is the UN report in 2014 brands North Korea as probably the worst human rights abuser on the planet. But on the other hand, it seems to be, at the end of the day, a real dilemma for Kim himself. You know, if he's going to improve the standard of living of his own people, which is what he's promised, he's also going to risk the bubble that he's built up in terms of cradle-to-grave propaganda that the people in the North live inside of. He could be pricking his own bubble, don't you think?
Yeah, that's always been the slippery slope that the Northern regime has faced. So the more you open up in order to enhance prospects of material gain and economic development, the more likely you're going to face the realities of open communication and open access to information by the citizenry. And so that is still the case, and it's actually happening right now from all reports that we've gotten, that there is this half-underground wave of information, access to South Korean cultural media, and other insights into the wider world that will shatter, if not already shattered, the carefully choreographed image within North Korea that has been developed over 70 years now, centered on the legitimacy of the Kim family's reign. And so that is ever present. Of course, they were talking like this 25 years ago, too, when the current leader's grandfather died, that here now we are going to see the quick implosion of the regime because this contradiction cannot be sustained. And yet, of course, it was sustained, or it has been overcome. And so I'm certainly not going to go out there and say that this is the beginning of the end of the regime because of this contradiction. And in fact, the summit, if it did anything else, it probably bolstered the likelihood that this regime is going to survive even stronger because it gave, for internal consumption, greater credibility. Although that legitimacy that's been based in North, that's been built up in North Korea, is much more than just simply saying, "Here, our leader now enjoys the stage on equal footing with the American president." But it certainly has helped the cause for the North Korean leadership, and I'm not talking just about the Kim family, although that is the center, but the entire regime structure and the structure of unequal and really radically exploitative hierarchy that has developed in North Korea.
Well, there's no question that much of their outlook in the North is based on paranoia and the belief that the U.S. is about to invade. And obviously that's in part rooted in their experience in the Korean War, when the United States had the most ruthless bombing campaign that just destroyed almost every building in the North. So that's understandable. And this criticism of President Trump for talking about getting rid of the or suspending the joint exercises, saying that they are provocative, a lot of military analysts find that a little unpalatable, because it's actually the regime in the North that's pretty provocative, threatening to turn Seoul into a sea of fire, which they are quite capable of doing. But in general, the paranoia of Kim himself, as opposed to the kind of state paranoia about being happy to be on a hair trigger, ready for the Americans to invade or ready to repel the American invasion. They've been living with that for decades. But what do you make of Kim's own paranoia? I mean, there were three planes. His own plane couldn't reach South Korea. So they had Chinese lent them three 747s. Two were acted as decoys, one of which apparently carried Kim's private toilet because he did. he didn't want anybody inspecting his stool, apparently. At least that's the theory. So what's he saying?
Sounds like urban legend.
Right. Well, this is being reported by Chosin Ilbo, which is a South Korean major newspaper.
Yeah, they have their sources. Yeah.
Right. So what do you make of his own paranoia? Is he still, even though this has given him a tremendous boost, this summit with Trump in Singapore, is he still looking over his shoulder? I know he murdered his uncle, he murdered his half-brother, both of whom were close to the Chinese. He doesn't trust the Chinese. Who's he afraid of?
You know, I think he's afraid of what is the most obvious, and that is an American invasion. And that is, as you say, rooted in history, and legitimately rooted in history. Of course, it's much more than simply the terrible experience of American bombing in the Korean War. That was used as the kernel for this enormous legitimation narrative that justified the Kim family's rule over the last 70 years. And so it's been dependent on this anti-American hostility, which is based on the reality of American bombing in the Korean War, but it's been, of course, completely inflated beyond that as a way to justify and legitimate the Kim regime. And so that is fundamentally what's going on here in North Korea. And so for Kim, there is this reality of a genuine fear of American attack, especially with Trump in power. But then there's also this utility of anti-American hostility, or this utility of this narrative that the Americans are on the verge of attacking North Korea for internal consumption. And it's all part of ultimately the process of maintaining the Kim regime and everything that surrounds the Kim regime in power. And so the paranoia partly is justified, but mostly it's a political tool, as it has been for the past 70 years.
Right, but if you get rid of the paranoia by getting rid of the exercises and reducing American troops in North Korea, which may not happen, but at least Trump is putting it on the table, if that's the glue, the fear of an external enemy attacking you at any moment, if that's the glue that holds a regime together, if you remove that fear or remove the justification for that fear, does that unravel the regime?
Well, you would think so, but it's not the only glue that keeps the regime together. There's this very strong anti-Japanese hostility, and so they can always tap into that as well. And in fact, that seems more likely as we go forward, if indeed this pans out as something that lessens the open hostility between North Korea and the United States. I imagine that the Northern regime, if indeed the exercises are stopped and if indeed there is a drawdown in tension, military tension and hostility between North Korea and the United States, then the Northern regime can point to the flip side of that, and that is the economic aid or the economic benefits that come with a friendlier relationship with the United States. I mean, there are various aspects of the grand narrative, mostly fabricated in North Korea to prop up the regime, and the American or the anti-American narrative is just one component of it. It's a very important component, but it's just one. They have other things to draw upon as well, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops as we go forward.
But just, you know, to pull back for a moment, it always struck me as being so unreal, this whole summit, and the fact that even before it began, Kim, in effect, had won, and there's so little came out of it. It just, I find it so extraordinary that a small country of 25 million people that can't feed its own people, that's the only country on the planet that's completely dark to satellites because it's, you know, basically little to no electricity, and they have, it's kind of a family kleptocracy. They have to resort to all kinds of crime, counterfeiting, $100 bills, drug trafficking, just to pay off the elite and keep them on board.
Yeah.
It just, I know that there's a book, The Tyranny of the Weak, but that, to my mind, really describes it. So how do we end up with the weakest country on the earth, in effect, ends up with nuclear weapons and ends up being on the same stage as equal players with the United States? It's pretty amazing,
it's because
isn't it?
It's because of the nuclear weapons, right?
I mean, well, that's how we all should get
danger.
A nuke. Is that what the lesson is here? If you want to be respected, get a nuke.
For this case, yes. I think that exactly is what has happened or appears to have happened. And that's the real danger or the cost of what took place yesterday with the summit. And that is that this has essentially justified the track that was taken by the Northern regime beginning in the 1990s of developing a nuclear weapons capability in order not only to defend itself against American attack, but to use it as a tool later on over the long term to get what it wants. And the first thing that it wants, of course, is regime continuity. And so that was promised in that statement yesterday, although there's not much substance to it. That was one of the things, of course, and that is security guarantees by the United States for North Korea. And so essentially what it did was it said, hey, the North Korean strategy worked. And the other thing that worked, and that was probably, of course, unintended, but then again, you never know with Trump, but he said in his press conference, you know, he was just going off in his typical rambling and incomprehensible way, but one of the things he said was, in order to go off on this track of praising Kim Jong-un, he said, well, Kim Jong-un, I admire him. He did an amazing job because when he took power or when he gained leadership, you know, he was very young and look what he's done, as if this was some kind of great feat on the part of a guy whose qualifications were that he was the grandson of the founder. Trump, I think, even used numbers like, you know, 1 in 10,000 people can accomplish something like that. That just feeds into the narrative within North Korea of the great special quality of his leader, you know. And so this is all unseemly and very distasteful, given the terrible circumstances faced by the North Korean people over the past several decades,
right,
and currently as well. But in the longer run, and maybe in the bigger picture, that, however terrible it is, might be worth it if indeed we get a de-escalation of hostilities, which means that we have a less of a likelihood of open armed conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, just in closing, though, if Trump is successful and gets reelected, and if he gets a boost from this summit,
God,
you know, the Trump dynasty may capture America. That is, frankly, my greatest fear.
Yeah, I mean, geez, I mean, it's, you would think that that's not a possibility, but yeah, I mean, Trump has absolutely zero appreciation for the significance of democracy itself. And for him, well, the people who appear most admirable, if that's the word, are other dictators. And so he sees himself as, of course, a strong man within and maybe constrained by a democratic system. You hate to think that someone in the United States can actually think like that and be elected to the presidency, but this kind of event demonstrates that might be a real possibility. So it is extremely disquieting, as you suggest.
Well, Kyung Moon Hwang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you again.
I appreciate it. And again, I've been speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who is professor of history and East Asian languages and cultures at the University of Southern California, who writes a biweekly column for the Korea Times of Seoul. His books include A History of Korea and Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. And he's the author of a recent study, Rationalizing Korea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the Canada Research Chair of Comparative Political Economy at York University, Leo Panitch.
Come, you masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Leo Panitch, who's the Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy and Distinguished Research Professor of Political Science at York University, the editor of the Socialist Register for 25 years. His many books include Working Class Politics in Crisis, A Different Kind of State, The End of Parliamentary Socialism, American Empire and the Political Economy of Global Finance, and The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Leo Panitch.
Happy to be on again.
Well, thank you, Leo. And, of course, I had to stay up last night to watch the summit in Singapore. And it's an extraordinary contrast to see Donald Trump describing his new best friend, the North Korean dictator, as a talented man who loves his country very much, compared to his newest global enemy, Canada's Prime Minister, who Trump refers to dismissively as though he was some kind of misbehaving schoolboy. He refers to him as Justin. So it's a pretty stark contrast. There in Canada, what do you make of this new strange double standard?
Well, you know, of course, everyone is unanimously outraged here. From left to right, there is complete unity on in support of Trudeau in the face of Trump's attack on him. But of course, you know, if you go back to where this all began, Trump began it with a attack on NAFTA. His you know, original campaign was oriented to NAFTA being the worst deal ever, even before he said Iran was the worst deal ever, and very different deals, of course. So that's what's going on here, I think, and we are very aware that this can have very significant implications for Canada. You know, it's an old story in Canada. We are so deeply integrated with the American economy. We are a dependency of the American economy in many ways. What is significant and why this has worldwide implications is that, as I've written before, a good part of the rest of the world, certainly not North Korea, has been Canadianized, and has that has been going on since the 60s, since even before NAFTA. That is, you know, the American investment, American direct foreign investment, American corporations have set up to manufacture and sell in other countries. And by virtue of that, these countries have their economies have become integrated with the American economy. And insofar as Americans have invited, in fact, needed foreign direct investment inside the United States to come in from abroad to offset American trade deficits, you know, this means that, and Merkel said this explicitly in the Quebec G7 summit to Trump, for two generations, you have encouraged, the Americans have encouraged the integration of our economies, of the European economies, of the G7 economies with the American. And now you, on your own, turn around and say you want to end that. So, you know, we're facing this more than anyone, of course, but it becomes a problem for the Europeans and for many other countries in the world.
Well, Robert Kuttner, the editor of The American Prospect, who incidentally was in many ways responsible for Stephen Bannon getting fired. And Bannon is, of course, the guy that's gotten Trump to tear up all these deals like TPP and go after NAFTA. Kuttner has a piece, Trump is right about NAFTA, but that doesn't make him pro-worker. That's what's extraordinary. Here is Trump pandering to the Rust Belt states here in the United States for the midterms and to get reelected in 2020. And he's also using this national security rubric to beat up on Canada because he doesn't want to go through the Congress.
Right.
And now you've got, oddly enough, a group of Republicans called Republicans Against Tariffs forming. So do you see any blowback brewing for Trump here in the United States?
Oh, yeah. There are very severe limitations on how far he can go. You know, insofar as he undertakes the massive tax cuts, the American capitalist class will go along with it and be happy with him. That's, after all, the standard formula for what Republicans do. They go on about deficits until they're in government. And then the main thing they're interested in is cutting taxes on the rich and powerful and on corporations. So they go along with that, but the American leading multinational corporations and investment banks who are so stuck in around the world, who are involved in this network integrated global production, which goes far beyond Mexico and Canada, but is obviously very deep there as well, they can't live with this. And the inconsistency here, even with regard to Trump's own history as a capitalist, is, of course, very significant. Because, you know, free trade agreements have not primarily been that much about reducing tariffs. The General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which, you know, went on from 1948 on, by the 1980s had reduced tariffs very significantly. These agreements were primarily about free capital movements. They were primarily about protecting the property of foreign capital in another country. And the American interest in that was primarily that. It was about the trade in services, especially in business services, consulting services, financial services, on which the Americans, in addition to high tech, are the world leaders. So, you know, so many of the things we take for granted, the iPhone, can only be produced in a range of countries. Insofar as Walmart operates through sourcing the jeans that you buy at Walmart in a way that it has to be shipped to Long Beach from Chinese textile plants, etc. You know, we're talking about an integrated world here, and one in which Trump himself, with all of his, of course, hotels and condos, etc., is heavily involved in. He can only go so far, precisely because the American interest in this is so related to there being free capital movements. And should this kind of behavior lead to those trade agreements being interrupted, what is being interrupted in a larger sense is the protection of capital by each state in the world. And they can't live with that. When the Americans are reluctant to sign on to a G7 communique that refers to the rule-based order, you know, the rules that are applicable here are less trade rules than the guarantee of property by states right around the world. That's what really matters here. And therefore, he can only go so far with this, and he only has an interest in going so far with this. You know, the American power is such that I think he will get his way in terms of reducing agricultural tariffs in Canada and in Europe, and do it in an asymmetrical way, moreover, whereby he'll still protect American agricultural interests. But, you know, I think he can only go so far before much more powerful forces in the American economy blow the whistle on him.
So yesterday, Leo, I spoke with an economist who was in the White House Trade Office for North America and was very familiar with NAFTA. And I asked him some of the questions that I've been asking you about possible blowback, particularly given the pandering to the Rust Belt and trying to get reelected in the midterms and in 2020. And he thought that the possible blowback might come that if Trump precipitates a tit-for-tat trade war, and you can see from what happened with Prime Minister Trudeau, you're saying how popular he is now. I mean, it's natural for politicians to, if the public turns against Trump, which they have in large part in this country, but in Canada even more so, and in Europe even more so, it doesn't hurt a politician to become anti-Trump. So if you get a situation where the rhetoric, not just Trump's heated rhetoric, but it's reciprocated, and you get into a kind of tit-for-tat trade war.
Yeah.
The analyst I had on yesterday, Matt Gold, said that he thinks that this could cause the stock market here to tank, and that could come back and backfire and bite Trump.
Yes, it could. I mean, it depends, of course, you know, how much posturing this is and how far this goes. It appears that what the American strategy in the NAFTA negotiations at the moment is to separate the Canadians and Mexicans. And, you know, originally there was a free trade agreement between the Canadians and Americans. It was the U.S.-Canada free trade agreement. The Mexicans were added on only 3-4 years later. They are two very, very different types of economies, of course. One of the worst provisions, one that, that probably doesn't bother Trump all that much, although he's happy to see it go, he says, is the Chapter 11 provision that allows corporations to sue governments for what? Introducing things like ecological requirements, regulations, which then hold up their development plans, and they claim that that amounts to expropriation. And then they take governments to the court and sometimes win, as they did Canada. Well, that was introduced specifically in NAFTA, but not in the Canadian-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, because they were worried about expropriations in Mexico, some of which had occurred in the early 1980s. So, you know, they are different. You know, there are different considerations that led to this multilateral three-pronged agreement. The Americans are probably trying to get, and they much prefer, bilateral agreements going. You know, that could yet happen. I do think, even if that does happen and you get some heavy American pressure on the Canadians and Canadians respond, there will be a massive response, not least because something like half of American states have half of their exports going to Canada. So there's a real price to pay, there's no question. On the other hand, one shouldn't minimize the extent to which the restructuring of the auto industry and the steel industry has hurt working-class communities. And the blithe promises that the Democrats who could elect Mickey, could run Mickey Mouse in most of those working-class communities in the Midwest since the New Deal and get them elected, the fact that they lost those communities to Trump is a reflection of the pain that working people have felt. Now, some of that restructuring, of course, involved moving plants to the American South. That's true, and to rural areas where it was more difficult to unionize. It wasn't just a matter of going to Mexico. So, you know, I think that there's no sense pretending that there hasn't been real pain here. Now, as you say, Trump is no great friend of the working man. Neither was Mussolini, but of course he made an appeal to the working man, as Trump is doing. It's a false appeal. It's an appeal that says we're going to protect your jobs and it's dubious about whether they will, while we will, you know, undermine your pension and health benefits. So, you know, I'm not saying that he is a friend of the working man. On the other hand, one shouldn't ignore the real contradictions that globalization has wrought inside every country in terms of increased inequality. And the reason that we have these really cynical patriots around the world being able to make hay against globalization is because it has produced real inequalities and contradictions inside every country. And that's been the problem, of course, of the free traders, not least the Social Democrats in the United States, the New Deal Democrats, who, you know, promised people that they'd be able to retrain so they could get jobs in the high-tech industry, et cetera, absurdly, which never came through, of course. And one does need to recognize that this is not, you know, just a matter of a false appeal. It's a matter of the traditional representatives of working class communities not having stood up for them. You even see this in L.A. If you go back to the closure of the Firestone plant, for instance, you can see that pain even in Southern California. And this does need to be addressed by progressives in our countries if we're not going to be subject to these cynical patriots, whose main interest, of course, is greater inequality, as we've seen evidenced in all kinds of policies that Trump has already carried through.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, just to broaden the perspective here, since we've had this summit in Singapore and China and South Korea are obviously going to play a big role. And the difference is, I think, that China is reaching out to the world by building roads, while the U.S. under Trump is building walls. But the main thing that Trump is playing on, which is a persistent myth in this country, and that's the myth of America being taken advantage of. He talked about our piggy bank being raided by foreigners. Mm. I mean, that is the most absurd thing, but yet it's very deeply felt. Americans think they're the most generous in terms of foreign aid, which is not true. They think they're being taken advantage of. They don't seem to have any concept of how lucky they are to have the global reserve currency, the dollar, and what an advantage that is. I don't see it. Do you in any
way? No, that's all true, but it is also true that in order to pull other countries into this U.S.-led, as you say, dollar-dominated global financial system, the Americans have been prepared to give certain concessions for a period to other countries. So it was the case in the post-war era that the German mark and the Japanese yen were much undervalued relative to the dollar. And that helped them become the major exporters they became. It is the case that the Americans have not insisted that the South Koreans and the Japanese open up their markets, their financial markets, and indeed part of their manufacturing markets, to American direct investment. And it has been the case that in order to draw them into, as I was saying before, these international agreements, which really are about opening up to American foreign investment, that yes, sometimes in these agreements, the Americans have allowed for arrangements, which they then, of course, and Trump represents this in a much greater way than before, try to claw back. And we saw that with Reagan and the voluntary quotas he got from the Japanese. You saw Bush introduce steel tariffs as well. Now, it's nothing of the order that you see here. And it didn't involve the assault on multilateral institutions like the G7 that Trump is engaging in. Now, this is what really could be biting him in the back end, biting Americans in the back end as a result of this, is that if there is now another financial crisis, and there's a good chance that there will be, the cooperation that's needed amongst the finance ministries of the world with the American Treasury and the central banks of the world with the Federal Reserve, and both the Treasury and the Federal Reserve are at the absolute center of this. They have got to manage containing these crises. The Treasury calls itself the firefighter, because it knows it can't prevent financial crises anymore, given how loose and volatile international finance is, built around New York and its satellite in London. But, you know, if you can't get this cooperation to stem a financial crisis, you know, then the whole system really is in massive trouble. And that's, I think, what one needs to look for most. The American state, and that's why I call it an empire, has been responsible for not only making this global capitalism, but for managing it. That has involved some concessions as well as a lot of coordination. And Trump is not playing that game. But not only that, he's undermining the capacity of American state institutions. The State Department, the Treasury, less so the Fed because it's more independent. And if those state institutions don't have the capacity to manage global capitalism, there's no other state in the world that does have that capacity. As you say, partly because the American state is responsible for the world's reserve currency, the dollar. This could really turn out to be a very big disaster in that sense.
Well, Leo Panitch, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very happy to talk to you again, Ian.
Thank you. So long. And again, I've been speaking with Leo Panitch, who's the Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy and Distinguished Research Professor of Political Science at York University and the editor of the Socialist Register for 25 years. And his latest book is The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.